G'day, Gladys and Poddies. Welcome to another LNL. In this program, we've dug deep into our treasure trove to bring you a classic interview from 2006 with a guest we miss a lot, the late Christopher Hitchens. Our topic, the timeless concept of rights, democracy and the welfare state. And Christopher is joined here by John Keane from Sydney University. G'day, Gladys and Potties. Welcome to another LNL. There's a great series of books published in Australia by Allen and Unwin called Books That Shook the World. We've got Plato's Republic, Darwin's Origin of the Species, the Quran, and Das Kapital. And you might recall that just a week or so ago, I chatted to Francis Wheen about that fine tome. Coming up, the Bible, Homer's The Iliad. This is really our books that shook the world, aren't they? Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and On War. But in between those, we've got the book the man we're going to discuss tonight, Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. I suddenly remembered something driving in to have this chat with Christopher Hitchens and John Keane, and that is that some years ago when I was working at a commercial radio station called 2UE, I had an alas poor Yorick experience. Someone brought in what they insisted was the skull of Thomas Paine. I remember it being mahogany in colour, and it had been scrimshawed, and that is the skull was covered in the most beautiful sort of filigree engravings, providing a provenance for the skull. Don't know what happened to it. I cannot imagine whether it's authentic. There might be more Thomas Paine skulls around than there are pieces of the one true cross, but I suspect we'll get closer to the real Thomas Paine this evening. His most famous works, Common Sense, Rights of Man and the Age of Reason, have had a profound influence on the French Revolution, the American Revolution, English radicalism, and the way all of us understand the concept of rights. Writer polemicist Christopher Hitchens, whose new book, Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, a Biography, is joined by John Keane. John, of course, founder and director of the Centre for the Study of Democracy at Westminster University in London, and a very important Thomas Paine scholar in his own right. John was on the programme about a month ago when we had a long discussion about war and democracy in ancient Athens. Oh, his book, Thomas Paine, A Political Life, was published by Bloomsbury a few years ago. Christopher is in California. We're here in Sydney, so let's get stuck into it. John, some of the basics of Paine's personal biography. Let's launch with his birth in 1737. Can you tell us about his early life as a corset maker, I understand?
Yes, he grew up in a small town in Norfolk, Thetford. His early life, half of his life was spent in England, and very little had been written about it, and it always struck me as absurd that biographers and all standard accounts of Paine began with him on the boat to Philadelphia, where within 18 months he writes the pamphlet of the American Revolution, Common Sense. The early life had a long life. The early life is one grows up in a small town in the shadow of the gibbet. It was where the annual trials were held and men were executed not very far from his little house. Father a Quaker, mother an Anglican, developed the skill of a corset maker, stay maker. Sacked by customs and excise, wrote a pamphlet anonymously in defense of the right of workers to form a trade union. Had a tragic...
Is that the case of the Officers of Excise?
Yes, a wonderful tract, well ahead of its time. The theme reappears in Rights of Man and other texts. Had a tragic first marriage. His wife and child died during childbirth. Despite all that's said subsequently, there's no evidence that he remarried. What effect it had on him psychologically is we could speculate about. Ends up in Lewes, in the town of Lewes in Sussex on the south coast of England. It's a very important town because it was a place of refuge for Republicans during the English Civil War and in the period of Restoration. And it's there that Paine is a member of the Headstrong Club. They drink ale and gin, and they discuss ideas about contemporary politics. And it's there as well that there is plenty of evidence that Paine first tried his hand with the quill and the inkpot, developed the art of writing in the vernacular. That, I think, is something that is of basic importance, this modernism of Paine, a man who said that he wrote using the ABCs of language for people who were illiterate, for people who would stand and listen to this prose and would be profoundly affected.
In parenthesis, John, could I possibly have been holding the real skull of Thomas Paine in that radio interview? Or are there a lot of contenders?
Well, I think as Christopher says in this great book, this new biography of Thomas Paine, I think Paine would have been appalled at any discussion about his bits and pieces. I think it is fitting, however...
Shouldn't it be in a left-wing reliquary somewhere?
Could be, but I think it is fitting that there is no resting place of Tom Paine. That is the really important symbolic point, that he gave gifts to the world. He often likened himself to a farmer who produced crops, and he wanted to scatter his pamphlets and his books to many millions of people to change their minds, to bring reason to the world, to bring the world to its senses. And it's fitting, I think, that he had no resting place. He's still alive.
Christopher, you place a lot of stress, understandably, on his religious background. You write that his Quaker dad forbade young Thomas from studying Latin as the language of monarchy and the Pope. Was the Quaker tradition of profound importance to his intellectual growth?
Oh, there seems to be no doubt of that. Not just the Quaker, but we could say the nonconformist. His father would have raised him, well, did in fact raise him, to remember that England hadn't always been the private property of monarchs, that within almost living memory, a monarch had had his head forcibly removed from his shoulders for being impious and for claiming the divine right of kings and for trampling on the rights of the common people, that there had been a time before the Norman conquest and the Latin Mass and all the obfuscations of power when there was an ancient wellspring of liberty that was the natural, inalienable property of all Englishmen. And I think as well as keeping him from the study of Latin, which he thought was symbolically profane, if you like, he also appears to have steered him towards the reading of Milton and Bunyan and the other grand writers of the good old cause of the Republic. And Milton's most famous line to some people, George Orwell being one of them, was, by the known rules of ancient liberty. These are things that monarchs and priests can never touch or take away.
Hmm. He later in life...
Of course, I should add, he was attacked from the... It's difficult to say whether it's the left or the right, but during the French Revolution, he was attacked very strongly by Jean-Paul Marat, among others, because he voted against the execution of the king and was in principle opposed to capital punishment, torture, and other barbarisms. And it was said that he shouldn't be allowed to vote in the French Assembly because his Quaker principles meant that he couldn't be enough of a revolutionary. That was a sectarian attack, but in a way it was choosing for him the positive bits of Quakerism, the bits that he admired. During the American Revolution, he turned his back on Quakerism because the Quakers were pacifist and wouldn't fight against King George and the Redcoats and were neutral. And at that point, he gave up his allegiance in the formal sense. But yes, I believe his nonconformist upbringing was and character was very, very central.
How is it, John, that he can set off for America with an introductory letter from no other, no less than Benjamin Franklin?
Yeah, this was, I think, through the Lewes connection, and it's a pretty modest letter. It asks the bearer to consider temporary employment for Thomas Paine.
Of a low order, too, one notices.
Yes. Yes. Little did the writer know, and the bearer of the letter, that this man would help to change the world by effecting the first and only successful English revolution, or if you like, British revolution against the British system. Common Sense was a remarkable literary success. It rolled off the presses in January of 1776.
What sort of numbers are we talking?
Hundreds of thousands of copies.
Is that right?
I think we're better informed about Rights of Man. Reliably, the figures are somewhere in Britain alone. By 1793, so when the two parts had appeared, the sales were somewhere between 200 and 250,000, a quarter of a million copies. This in a country of 10 million, one in 40 people. That means every household would have heard of it in a population that was largely illiterate. Paine characteristically earned, as far as I can see, about £1,000 profit, royalties on this, which in very Paineite way he donated to the Society for Constitutional Information.
What's the atmosphere in Philadelphia when he arrives? Is it electric? Christopher, yeah, okay.
Well, you couldn't say that Philadelphia was exactly 5th century Athens, but you could say that it had been becoming for some time a magnet city for the intellect, and especially for the free-thinking type of intellect. I'll give you an example. I think I mentioned in my book, Joseph Priestley, the effective discoverer of oxygen, who was a Unitarian, a Republican, a great sympathizer of the American Revolution, a believer in science, even though he did believe in the phlogiston theory for a while, had his laboratory smashed in Birmingham by a church and king Tory lynch mob, who broke up his instruments and accused him of being an atheist and all the rest of it. And he decided, all right, if I can't work in England, I'll take ship, I'll get out of here. And he went to Philadelphia. People like Dr. Benjamin Rush, great physician, founder of the American Anti-Slavery Society, went there. Benjamin Franklin, of course, a very famous citizen. If you went there, as Paine did, when he got off the boat, he may have had few friends and no money, but there were bookstores, pubs, coffee shops, small magazines, independent newspapers. It was a city of ferment, I would say, rather than electricity, though, of course, Mr. Franklin did lend a certain element of the electric and in a form of a lightning rod in more than one sense. It was the ideal revolutionary centre of its time.
John Adams wasn't a great fan of Paine's, was he, John Keane? He, and later, as president, he was really very opposed to him.
Yes, for a variety of reasons. They fell out over Paine's proposal in Common Sense that there should be a unicameral legislature. None of this two houses stuff, because it reminded him of the Lords and its base in aristocratic property and pomp and guff and war. Adams disagreed profoundly with Paine about that. I think it's also obvious from the correspondence and the context that there was a kind of biochemical allergic reaction between them. Paine, you know, is a rough upstart. This is the point. He comes from nowhere, from a little town in Norfolk, and he is a commoner. He's not a man of property. And I think you can see quite a lot of Paine's doings as the work of someone from the margins.
Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, but could I just add to that?
Yes.
Because it's a very important point that Professor Keane makes, is that it's one of the benchmark elements of Paine's writing. Up until then, the word democratic or democratical, which was the way Adams used to express it, was always used as an insult. He'd say, your democratical ideas, as if democracy meant what some Greeks would once have called ochlocracy, a mob rule. Hmm. It wasn't until Paine that the word democratic became a positive and not a pejorative word. And so that's important to remember and bear in mind in context. And then We have good reason to know that Adams was very upset hearing Paine one evening at a dinner ridiculing the stories of the Old and New Testament and saying that they were myths and fables and legends. It was profoundly shocked that anyone would ever risk such a blasphemy.
Christopher, how did his ideas influence the writing of the Declaration of Independence and, in due course, the US Constitution?
Well, there's an unanswered question here. At least it's unanswered by me. Perhaps Professor Keane has a new hypothesis, but it seems almost certain that Paine had read John Locke, especially his essay on civil government. Paine makes this complicated by appearing to deny that he did. He may have been sensitive to a charge of plagiarism, but if you look at what John Locke wrote and you look at the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, it's clear that Jefferson has certainly read Locke. Paine, who was at his elbow much of the time and whose work Jefferson had obviously read, denies reading it, but there's a sort of triangulation there of where do rights come from, where do human beings come from, where do rights and duties originate. And what happens in the American Revolution is what happens as the redcoats sail away from Yorktown and the russet-coated revolutionaries strike up the band and play The World Turned Upside Down. They invert John Locke. Instead of saying life, liberty, and property, which was his mantra, they say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They don't mention property rights. They mention human rights. And that governments can only be derived from the just consent of the governed. And no such subversive words have ever been inscribed on the foundation of any government before.
It's very likely Christopher is right. It's about this Locke connection. I think it's also very likely that in Lewis, if you look at the Lewis Register, this weekly newspaper, it's full of Republican ideas and neo-Roman ideas, written constitutions, separation of powers, anxiety about standing armies for what they can do, the importance of rights, the language of citizens and
secularism,
and yes, the general attempt to detach government and law from religion. But I think it's also interesting that Paine, who has quite a brain, certainly a political brain, but a capacity, a self-taught capacity to ponder things that he's inherited. Remember, he's a man who thinks that the dead shouldn't rule the living. And in this case...
Sorry, just dwell on that for a second.
Yes.
The listener would be most grateful for elucidation. The dead shouldn't rule the living.
He asks in Rights of Man, who is to decide, the living or the dead? And Paine's point is that those who talk tradition are typically foxes and lions who use talk of tradition to justify storages of power and influence. And the point is that man, as Paine puts it, has a capacity for reason, the capacity to rethink things. And that's what he does in Common Sense. What I find remarkable about this pamphlet, quite aside from its vernacular language, its freshness, its sense that something new is possible, that we have it in our power to begin the world over again, is the way in which he introduces the whole idea, taken from Locke but put into motion, that this is a rebellion of society against empire, of society against the state. I think he is the first person to speak in entirely modern terms of civilized society or civil society as the basic ingredient of a free and, as he would say later, democratic representative republic.
Yeah, but I remember, I just want to add something to the FMA, Philip.
Yes, of course.
One of the first speeches I ever heard against the Tories way back in the 64 election was someone saying, when you hear the Tories talking about tradition, what they mean is that the dead men should vote, that they'll be the ones who are the chief whips of these people. Paine was also arguing, don't forget, with Edmund Burke, the most celebrated Whig, right-wing Whig of his time, who said, we don't need a revolution in England or anywhere else. We don't need one in England because we've already had one. We had one in 1688. It established what we call the Glorious Revolution, our current constitution, unwritten though it is. This, he said, is a pact made for all time between the English people and the House of Orange, House of William and Mary, and it cannot be altered. It's written in stone. And Paine said, what could be more ridiculous? No parliament of any age or time, and no treaty made by any group of people, however sapient, can possibly be expected to bind us who are living nearly a century later. Hmm. In fact, more or less exactly a century later. And that's one of the ways in which he adds, man can have no property in man.
I'm glad you raised that, because he did complain bitterly about slavery, didn't he? He wanted it in the Constitution.
Strangely, when I first read that Paine had said that, I thought that must be an attack on slavery, on the holding of humans as property. In fact, it's not. It says man can have no property in man because he can't bind a succeeding generation. The other interesting thing is that, and it's ironic in the context, as against Burke and the Whigs and Tories, for the radical side, Paine said, actually, we have a longer tradition than theirs. We have a tradition that goes back before the Norman Conquest. We can remember before the usurping, illegitimate, I have to say, he used the word bastard, William I of Normandy, ever set foot on our soil. So he was capable of saying that tradition counted, but he would always argue that tradition couldn't be binding. But by all means, let's go on to slavery, because it's very important.
Before, I want to look at the Revolutionary War and his role in it at least briefly, but let's make another point. I think both of you agree that it was Paine who first proposed the name the United States of America?
Probably.
Christopher? Yes. I don't know of a good rival.
It's important to just ponder for a few seconds the revolutionary effect of that little clutch of words. When Paine returns from the United States of America to come back to Europe to build a bridge, but gets caught up in the French revolutionary events, he says in several letters that he and other Americans feel different. They feel as though their whole perception of the world has changed. They feel odd in the European context because something new has happened, and this was helped by the invention of a new language of politics, including this clutch of words, the United States of America.
Christopher, I think at this moment I'd like you to read These Are the Times That Try Men's Souls. Let's listen to the quality of language.
Well, this is his second pamphlet for the American Revolution. The first, which was called Common Sense, as you know, summoned Americans to throw off the British yoke and the British connection and to declare themselves independent. And the second one, The Crisis, was written when the war was going very badly, when it was at its lowest ebb, and it looked as if Washington would be defeated. And it begins like this. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of men and women. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered, yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. 'Tis dearness only that gives everything its value.
That's right.
I compare
that's
it,
right
I,
up there with the Agincourt speech, isn't it?
Well, that's my only... I mean, I'm glad you like it, not too exaggerated comparison. I'm sure we know that Paine read Shakespeare at Thetford. And the thing that came straight into my mind was King Henry's defiance to the French King's Herald. It's actually not part of the Night Before Agincourt speech, but where he says, I think I have this right, we would not seek a battle as we are, nor as we are we say we will not shun it. And at that point, the French Herald's expression changes a bit.
I must warn the listener that we will, later in this program, the three of us will sing together. We're going to sing you a song, but we will not reveal what the song is quite yet. I will, however, reveal that this is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and on your pod. and that we're discussing Thomas Paine with two of his biographers, Christopher Hitchens and John Keane. And Christopher, off-air, was saying that he acknowledges a great debt to John. Perhaps you'd like to say that out loud now, Christopher.
Oh, yes, especially since, except that it will now sound too much like a mutual aberration study, because he so kindly described my little book as great earlier on. If this doesn't sound like a back scratch, I can promise you I say it in the acknowledgements of my book, too. Professor Keane's biography is one of those great quarries of stuff from which the humbler artisans like myself carry off carts of stone for our more modern.
So he's Carrera and you're Michelangelo.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
Okay. Now, Paine returns to England in about 1787, I think, and his most influential book, The Rights of Man, comes along pretty shortly thereafter. What was he setting out to do with that book, John?
Initially to explain to an English-speaking audience the events, the remarkable events that had broken out in France. It begins as a broadside against Edmund Burke. I think it's, though strange, that that broadside tends to become less important through the course of the second part of the book. But what Paine wants to say is that it's time for us to realize that revolutionary events are spreading now from west to east. The American events, the defense of rights of man, of written constitutions, of republics, is now, the struggle for that is now breaking out in France, and we need to repeat that in the British case. So it's a strong attack on the notion of inherited government, of inherited authority, that the dead could rule the living. It's an attack on aristocracy. Paine is contemptuous of their lazy enjoyment of spoils, the fact that they leech off the common man and woman. And above all, it is this book, Rights of Man. The first part in particular is a strong defense of the view that rights are God-given to each individual. They are natural, and there are also civil rights. Natural rights are given to each individual in, for example, the capacity for reason, the capacity for speech. Also, in the entitlement, natural rights include the entitlement to be free from fear and want and hunger. Civil rights are those that are protected, crystallized in law and government. What Paine wants to see is a brand new type of a form of government in Europe, which he thinks will lead to the emancipation of the common man and woman, and will also put an end to war.
At about the same time, Christopher Hitchens, Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, is rolling off the presses, and it's interesting to see how Paine favours free trade over feudalism, and you make the point that he anticipates Karl Marx's view on capitalism. In what sense?
Well, among other things, by echoing what Smith had said about the wastefulness of colonies and of empires, and also by using, I forget exactly where I place this now, the term the invisible hand, in a way that one can't be sure whether Paine borrowed it from Smith or Smith from Paine. I would still say, though, that the main surviving interest of the book, which has all the qualities that Professor Keane just mentioned to it, is still the confrontation with Edmund Burke. Because what people forget, because Burke has come down to us as a essentially a rank English Tory, is that he was at the time an Irishman, a secret Catholic at a time of penal laws against Catholicism, a Whig, and someone who had written his own polemics against British imperialism, particularly in India.
Well, I'm glad you remind the reader of how good Burke was at his best, wasn't he? Because he was a most significant fellow.
He was quite extraordinary, and he had a strong sense of outrage. He pled for the Bengalis and the other Indian subjects of the company and of the exploitation of Warren Hastings, tried to have the man impeached, very nearly succeeded, had been retained in the House as spokesman for the colonists of New York for the demand for rights to be extended to the Americans. Paine very much hope that he would join him in doing the same for France and for Ireland. But Burke wouldn't have it. Burke could see that there was something diseased in the French Revolution, something resentful and nihilistic, and militarized and violent. And he feared, and said with great prescience, that he thought it would end in the dictatorship of a single general, in what we would now call Bonapartism. And the passage in which he says he fears this is spine-chilling to the present day, because it's uncannily prescient.
John, it's interesting to realise that the Rights of Man raises such issues as interventionist programmes of welfare distribution, old age parent pensions, marriage allowances, for heaven's sake, maternity benefits.
Yes, universal education for children, even a grant to newlyweds. He had a whole...
Our treasurer could learn a lot from this, couldn't he?
Yes.
His desperate ability to increase our birth rate.
Yes, and called for the disbanding of soldiers and the provision of an allowance for them. The right to employment, for instance, in Westminster and London. Not a workhouse, but a place where people could go to find work in order to live and to live better. And... this package of proposals is very remarkable. Some of them, I mean, I think all of them subsequently came to be part of a public policy agenda. Some of them took a long time. The proposal, for example, that each child should receive a grant has only been sanctioned thanks to Gordon Brown in the British case several years ago, baby bonds. The whole point of Paine is that if rights are natural and they are the foundation of politics and nobody can take them away, because that's tyranny, that's despotism, then the transition to a world where there is an equality of rights and citizenship, of self-government, requires the support of those who have lost, of the powerless, and hence this package of welfare proposals.
Christopher, I don't like to be vulgar about book sales, but it is extraordinary the way Rights of Man sold. I think they somewhat outsold your own fine efforts on Kissinger and Mother Teresa. We're looking at a book which I understand outsold Shakespeare and is still one of the biggest sellers in the English language.
Oh, but that's only in English. Remember that even at the time, it was published very quickly in a German edition because there was a very large German-speaking population in the 13 colonies, and Paine was always very aware that it wasn't just Englishmen whose rights were being upset by what was, after all, a German monarchy. So there was a German edition as well. I can't, without checking, tell you how many other languages it was translated into, or how fast, but it was a remarkable number for its time. In other words, it wasn't just a local bestseller, but even by our current standards of celebrity and success, it was more like a world bestseller, an international runaway hit.
Well, it would have been an Oprah Winfrey choice.
Very popular in Ireland, very, very popular in... extremely popular in Ireland and Scotland, but as far away as... Croatia for some reason, Portugal.
Yes,
it ignited a sympathetic audience pretty much anywhere that such a book could.
And it was transported to Australia. Thomas Muir was one who got 14 years transportation for urging publicly people to read Rights of Man. And when you look at some of the innovations that happened in 19th century Australia, political innovations like the secret ballot, like the Eureka Stockade, the call for audit commissions, the rights of women to vote and to stand, proportional representation. These are all firsts in Australia.
We've got to put this in the context, too, of literacy levels, do we not? Which makes it even more astonishing.
It is.
Well, that was his big advantage, I think, in point of time, was that he was writing at a moment when there was a newly literate artisan class available to him, and even if they couldn't all read, they all knew someone who could read to them in the alehouse or sometimes even from the pulpit. So it was universally accessible. And the remarkable thing to me, reading him, and those of your listeners who remember the paragraph I just read, which is, you know, beautifully hewn English, is that he thought he was consciously writing down to a more rough and ready audience. And he was often accused of using a very vulgar form of the language. If you read even a stave of it now, it puts to shame the average vernacular that we employ in our politics.
John, I passed over too quickly the Australian connection. Can you tease that out a little?
It's, a good book needs to be, or a good radio program or a good television program needs to be done on this. There's plenty of fragmentary evidence of not merely the survival, but the flourishing of Paynite ideas in all kinds of circles. And it's not only those who were transported who are very much victims of the French Revolutionary Wars and the attempt. The whole conquest of Australia is an attempt partly to outmaneuver the French in geopolitical terms, but it's also that successive waves of immigrants in the early 19th century are those who know about this book because it has been an enormously stunning success. And I agree very much with Christopher about the luck that Paine had with this newly literate artisan class. But I think as well, Paine understood supremely that the printing press, a gift to humanity, was something new in human affairs, that it became possible to use the printing press as a midwife of public opinion making, of public debate, of public controversy, the development of a public sphere that should stand between those who govern and citizens. And hence, Paine's, I think that point remains a perennial point, that despotism, sclerosis in government, tyranny happens when publics dry up. And it's to Paine as well, I agree with Christopher, that this transformation of language, the freshness, the vernacular, you know, the world is my country, all mankind are my brethren, and to do good is my religion.
Oh, and the eyes still brim with tears, don't they?
And also, stuff, yeah. Also, one is struck, I think, when you reread Paine, you come across gems like this one that have an absolutely unintended but stunning reference. It's a little sentence about the damage that organized religion has brought to the world. The whole religious complexion of the modern world, writes Paine, is due to the absence from Jerusalem of a lunatic asylum. that thought has occurred to me in the past.
And
week.
You know something. There is a thing called the Jerusalem syndrome that the local police now know what to look for.
Yes.
Know how to look for. Yes. People who come to Jerusalem about to proclaim themselves the Redeemer, and there's a special locked ward for people who soak up the atmosphere too willingly.
Yes.
This would be a criticism from my side against Paine, in that, if only for a slight hypocrisy, he knew very well that some of his readers, his audience, would have learned a bit of Bunyan and a bit of Milton, and perhaps a bit of Shakespeare, but they would all know their Bible in one form or another. And in Rights of Man, he makes many opportunist allusions to how in the Old Testament monarchy is condemned, which it isn't really. It is sometimes, but not generally.
Gentlemen, and we're rapidly...
Only when he comes to write The Age of Reason, which he does more or less in prison and when he thinks he might die, and says, actually, I've been looking at these holy books and I think they're all nonsense and they're all legend and they're all man-made. A lot of his friends, including John Adams again, and enemies, said, well, why didn't you say that in the first place? You gave us the impression you were a digger, leveller, Cromwellian, Protestant hedge priest against the monarchy. We didn't realise that you were not a good Christian.
We're running out of time. We haven't even started on this bloke. So let's look...
Barely got our trousers on.
Let's briefly look at a number of fascinating points or moments. Christopher, why the change of dedication? The first part of Rights of Man, George Washington. The second part, to a French aristocrat.
Yes, and revolutionary. It's interesting, the first part of Rights of Man is the most revolutionary part. It's the attack on Burkitt's The Great Defence of 1789 and the Fall of the Bastille, and it's dedicated to the most conservative revolutionary on the planet, George Washington, perhaps the most conservative revolutionary in history. I think that's explained by the fact that the Marquis de Lafayette gave Thomas Paine the key of the Bastille to take back as a present to George Washington, on the wall of whose house in Mount Vernon, Virginia, it still hangs. You can go and see it today. And that same Marquis, whose name shouldn't fool you, his noble title shouldn't fool you, was the most revolutionary person of his day. I mean, he fought in with great gallantry and distinction against the King George's Redcoats in the American Revolution, with enormous courage in the early days of the French Revolution, finally falling foul of the Jacobins, and then returning very late in his life to take part as commander of the National Guard at the barricades in the Revolution of 1848. And to this really revolutionary internationalist, glamorous figure, the more conservative part of the book is dedicated, the one that carefully adds up how much a welfare state would cost and measures it against the boring expenditures of William Pitt's treasury. I think it's rather a nice ironic pairing of dedication.
Gentlemen, I think it's about time to sing at least one verse from this parody of God Save the King. Christopher, can you put it into context before we assail the listener with our fine baritone voices?
Yes, those of your listeners who like this kind of thing, and I know there are a lot, should probably have already heard, and some of them will have, of a man called Joseph Mather, who was a radical artisan, a file hewer, in fact, in Sheffield, and a great radical in revolution. And he wrote a parody of the newly coined national anthem.
The first national anthem in history, you say?
First national anthem in history, and the one that was originally sung to protect the Hanoverian throne from Scottish rebels, and then became, as you know, the most mournful dirge of a national anthem.
Still sung here in Sydney, I've discovered.
And still in the Antipodes sung, and its first line changes whenever the female or male line predominates. I would say the first and the last verse might be the ones to do.
I think that's a good idea. So let us start with verse one, ladies and gentlemen. If you are downloading,
on your call,
this is something you'll want to keep forever. This is unique to hear Christopher Hitchens, John Keane, with a little backing from myself, singing this wonderful, wonderful anthem.
On your beat, then.
One, two. God save great Thomas. Come on, that's a shambles. Let's start again. That was terrible. One, two, three. God save great Thomas Paine. His rights of man explain to every soul. He makes the blind to see what dupes and slaves they be. And points out liberty from pole to pole. Despots may howl and yell, though they're in league with hell, they'll not reign long. Satan may lead the van and do the worst he can. Pain and his rights of man shall be my song.
And they're coming to get us. The men
up the Republic.
The men in white coats. Now, John, this was a part of the campaign to finally get rid of the monarchy. It didn't seem to work.
No, and you may know that Paine, a superstar in the London scene, by the spring of 1792, is issued with proceedings charged with seditious libel. He is ordered to appear in court in mid-December 1792 at the Guildhall, where he subsequently was tried as a wicked, malicious, and ill-disciplined person, and managed to escape by the skin of his teeth, thanks to advice from his friend William Blake.
Wonderful association.
You must go, or you are a dead man, said Blake to him one evening, and that he did. And I describe in my biography, it's a difficult moment, where I tried to write it so that readers would feel sad. You know, Paine is stoned from the beach as he gets on to this little ship to cross to Pas-de-Calais, where the good citizens have elected him as their representative to the Convention, which will draw up the new rules of the game in France. And luckily for Payne, the boat took off 20 minutes before the warrant for his arrest arrived. There began a difficult and very contested saga of the legacy of Payne. I think it's not true that the country became deeply nationalist and monarchist. There is certainly that tendency that fueled the revolutionary wars, ending, of course, in the defeat of Napoleonic France in 1815. Because there's plenty of counter-evidence that in all kinds of areas in Britain, the spirit, the Paynite spirit, did not die. And that out of that, I think you need to take that into account to explain the remarkable things that soon happened, culminating in the 1832 Reform Bill, but in the development of all kinds of politics from below, and a republican instincts, I think, that are not by any means dead.
Christopher, he's got a great sense of timing. He arrives in France just in time for the Reign of Terror, and as you've already mentioned, memorably argues against the execution of King Louis. How did he... It must have been an overwhelming vastation for him.
Oh, yes, because he had hoped for another version of a replantation in Europe of the American revolutionary idea with separation of powers and all the rest of it. Instead, he found, and particularly with separation of church and state, instead he found the Jacobins wanting to nationalize the church, which is a slightly different thing, and also property question, which means the church and the state become fused, with a proposal for people's courts instead of a constitutional court, and with a thirst for retribution, which he distrusted. He wanted to begin again without executions and lynchings and all the rest of it. And because the king had been a friend to America, George Washington certainly had his portrait on his wall. I doubt actually Thomas Jefferson did, but many, many American revolutionaries in their ordinary homes had pictures of the French royal family as having been their great ally. He beseeched the French Convention not to exact the penalty of death, and very nearly carried the day, as a matter of fact. But from then on, he was a marked man. He was thought of as unsound and perhaps unwilling to press things to their pitiless conclusion.
He was disappointed.
In other words, the great, if you wanted to sum up his grandeur, I would do it like this. Not that you did ask me, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'll be quick. He wanted the American Revolution to be much more radical. He wanted it to be much more deep-going, more democratic, in particular to abolish the appalling original stain of slavery, the traffic in human beings. And in France, he wanted the revolution to be less extreme and more democratic, and in the sense of physical cruelty and violence, more mild. I think those two stands fighting within the ranks of the two revolutions he supported mark him as a very exceptional person.
Christopher, is it not surprising that even after Napoleon declares himself emperor, he still makes fond remarks about boning?
It is
surprising. He hoped England would lose the war with France, for example.
And he thought that the news from Trafalgar was all got up by the press. Yes, he never quite lost the hope that the Hanoverian monarchy would be overthrown and defeated. That's why I slightly disagree with Professor Keane here. I do think he missed the boat of British public opinion at that point. There were a lot of revolutionaries and republicans fighting in British ranks and on British ships who were fighting only for England, not for the monarchy. I didn't particularly like France, but might have sympathized with the revolution. But when Napoleon declares the revolution over, has himself crowned as an emperor by the Pope, no less, the new Protestant revolutionary artisans of Britain say, well, we are not for this guy. He's no longer the carrier of liberation.
John,
and Payne doesn't realize what's happened to the British, as they now are, the Britons, not just the English, in his absence.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I'm looking at the clock and trying to get a few more bits and pieces in here. John, he writes The Age of Reason while he's in the slammer in France. What was the aim of that book?
It's called Age of Reason. It's a text that appeared first in French, interestingly, and it is, in a way, a summary of Paine's view of organized religion. A strong defense runs through it of his belief in reason, in universal rights, and it's a strong attack on organized religions of all kinds. I think it's in places a rambling text. It's full of venom for certain enemies. But what's important is to understand that this text got Paine into very, very deep trouble when he returned to the United States of America. I think it is the first recorded media hunt against a public figure. He had a terrible time, slagged off as atheist, a drunkard, a coward, a man who never washed, always soaked in gin, and above all, it was said that this man was a profound enemy of the new republic. Paine was often a master of timing. He was, and he was lucky, but in his return to America as the author of Age of Reason, he found himself caught up in another religious renaissance. Much can be learned, I think, from Paine for the way in which he handled that media hunt against him by organized Christianity. He had his supporters, but he struck back with the quill. He gave speeches wherever he could, but slowly, painfully, sadly, he was forced out of the public domain, and he died penniless in New York City.
Christopher, you make the point that Thomas Paine is, and I quote, shamefully unacknowledged by the Democratic Republic that he lived and died to bring about. Who are his standard bearers today?
Well, I don't believe we can say that there is one, because the connection in many people's minds between defending human rights and defending secularism and reason has been somewhat sundered. I would add to what Professor Keane just said. The last sentences of the Rights of Man say that the present age will hereafter merit to be called the Age of Reason, and the Age of Reason begins by saying that it is the right of every man to his own religious opinion. I think The Age of Reason is a sort of sequel, intended as such. And what he's saying to people is, if you want to have an Age of Reason, you'll have to have human rights. In other words, you're going to throw off the shackles of superstition. And you can't establish human rights without proclaiming that an Age of Reason is necessary to do so. And this, to me, self-evident proposition is muffled very much in a time where many of those who claim to speak for human rights say that it's an attack on human rights if you criticize somebody's religious belief or if you offend their deeply held faith. That is, of course, quite antithetical to the Paineite project.
Unfortunately, we have to wind up, although John is desperate to make another point. Thank you, guests. Christopher's new book, Christopher Hitchens' book, is called Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, a Biography. And John Keane's book, Tom Paine, A Political Life, was published by Bloomsbury. That classic LNL was broadcast in 2006. Stick around now for the news on RN, and we'll see you next week.